This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Now, Air America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the No Boring Zone.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. How can we restore America to being a constitutionally limited representative democratic republic? How can we restore the rule of law? How can we elevate the Constitution to the status it once had and elevate our nation to being the example, the beacon, the city on the hill, to quote John Winthrop, paraphrased by both JFK and Ronald Reagan, that every other country in the world looks to and says, we want to be like that. Because right now, the countries that are looking at us and saying, we want to be like that, are not exactly the kind of countries that I think any of us would want to live in. Bruce Fine is with us. Bruce Fine is a constitutional scholar, a lawyer, international consultant with Bruce Fine and Associates in the Litchfield Group. He's also the chairman of the American Freedom Agenda, their website, AmericanFreedomAgenda.org, an organization devoted to restoring checks and balances and protections against government abuse. He served in the Justice Department during the Reagan administration as general counsel of the Federal Communications Commission and has been affiliated with conservative think tanks such as the American Enterprise Institute and the Heritage Foundation, and now writes a weekly column for both the Washington Times and Politico.com. Bruce Fine, welcome to the program.
Thank you for that introduction.
You're welcome, and we're very pleased to have you with us. And the AmericanFreedomAgenda.org I've spent a little time on your website. I think it's just great. You describe yourself as a conservative, and B, you were one of the guys who authored the original articles of impeachment against Bill Clinton, if I have that information correct.
Yes, I think it is conservative philosophy at its finest to be worried about unchecked power, that the fundamental theorem of government propounded by the Founding Fathers was that since men are not angels, every branch of government needs checks and supervision to avoid extreme abuses of power and folly of the kind we're witnessing in Iraq. The extreme abuses of power can be illustrated by our policy of kidnapping, throwing into dungeons, torturing people, and dumping them out abroad. And the Founding Fathers knew that without any checks, human nature would cause these kinds of abuses. That's why we need to restore the Constitution.
In fact, you were paraphrasing James Madison there in the Men Are Not Angels.
Yes.
So the specific step that you're recommending as a conservative, as somebody who's been affiliated with the Heritage Foundation, the American Enterprise Institute, all these extraordinary credentials that I shared with our listeners, the specific step that you're recommending to help us restore constitutional law of the United States is?
Well, there are 10, but let me enumerate the ones that are perhaps most easily understood by your audience. One, we would end military commissions. Military commissions combine the functions of judge, jury, and prosecutor in a single branch, the executive branch. I think the last time I encountered that was in the Red Queen in Alice in Wonderland. It's something you might expect in the Soviet Union under Stalin. But everybody knows that if someone accuses you and then puts you on trial, they're likely to find you guilty, because why would they accuse you unless they thought you were guilty in the first place? And there's been no showing that we have a need for these military commissions. They were sat dormant for 6 years. People are tried before the military commissions for the same crimes there can be tried in civilian courts, and that's one reform that we think needs to go. A second would be the president's claimed authority to pluck any American citizen out of his home and say, you're an enemy combatant, I'm going to detain you indefinitely on Guantanamo Bay, and you have no right to confront your accusers, you have no right to be charged and prosecuted in a court, you just sit there as an enemy combatant and denied access to any court which would be required to prove the factual foundation for your detention. I mean, this is quite frightening. That is, the president earlier on had plucked not a citizen but a resident alien from his home in Illinois, stuck him in a brig, and without any charge or accusation has let him rot there for years. A court finally ordered him released as a what you might call a political prisoner. That case is now in the U.S. Supreme Court. But the president continues to insist he has this power over citizens. Another abuse that we would prevent would be the president's claimed authority to authorize the National Security Agency to intercept all of our emails and phone calls based upon his claim that we are implicated with Al-Qaeda.
Indeed, and enter our homes.
And enter, break and enter homes, open our mail, even kidnap us. The gist of the president's theory of Article 2, that's the article that describes executive power, is that when he says we're at war with terrorism, he then cannot be restrained in any way whatsoever, including assassinations, from attempting to gather foreign intelligence. And when he's confronted with, well, is there no stopping point? You can commit burglaries. You can do anything, brutalize people, torture people to gather foreign intelligence. The response is not that he doesn't have that power, but at present, by his great benevolence, he's not doing it yet, so let's not worry. Another theory that he has is that he can identify or list you or me or one of the organizations we belong to as a foreign terrorist organization based on secret evidence. So persons who had a personal vendetta against us could make allegations to the CIA or to the State Department that we're somehow are friendly with Osama. We couldn't ever see any of that, and we could be listed as a terrorist and have all our bank accounts frozen and make it criminal for us to engage in any business activity. We think that ought to end. Another abuse that needs to be addressed is the prospect of prosecuting the media for revealing national security abuses under the Espionage Act of 1917. This administration has taken the argument that the New York Times or the Washington Post, who respectively had published the National Security Agency's illegal domestic surveillance program and the use of secret prisons to torture in Eastern Europe, could be prosecuted as criminals for exposing the criminal activities of the United States government. That seems to me not an acceptable statute to have as a sort of Damocles over the media. And that
it seems to be the opposite of it seems to be the opposite, frankly, of what the founders had in mind when the First Amendment was passed, and they picked out of all of the thousands of potential industries in the United States, including the arms manufacturing industry. They picked out one industry to specifically protect in the Constitution, that being the press, the media.
Yes. They knew that the organized scrutiny of government was essential if democracy in Republican form was to flourish, because the government has an inclination to lie. I think President John Kennedy once prescribed a right to lie by government. And for good or for ill, you've got to accept that they will embellish the truth. And, of course, we know about the notorious weapons of mass destruction in Iraq that actually weren't there, and other lies and disseminations designed to destroy enemies, as Joseph Wilson or Valerie Plame.
Sure.
And it's equally been true that the administration has blatantly misrepresented the facts on the ground in Iraq after the surge or otherwise. You need the media there in order to check the inclination of the government to lie to you. And that's why we want to encourage their candid and robust reporting.
Bruce Fein, one of the remedies that you have suggested for all of these violations that you've cataloged, and there are more, and we'll get into them as we continue to talk in the program, but I wanted to get to this end point right away, and then we can kind of work backwards from it. One of the remedies that you have recommended, not so much as a punitive remedy, at least in my understanding of your logic here, but rather as a tool to restore constitutional government, is the impeachment of George W. Bush and Dick Cheney.
Yes, that is correct. The Founding Fathers described impeachable offenses as crimes against the Constitution, crimes against the processes of government that they thought were what we might style the scientific method for coming upon political moderation and political truths. And both the President and Vice President have demonstrated a sneering contempt for any check and balance on their claimed authorities. Total disregard for both the written and unwritten rules of constitutional law and separation of powers. The most recent incidences, I suppose, are the president's instruction to Harriet Myers and Sarah Taylor. They're not to answer questions, even if they want to, that he says they shouldn't answer relating to the firing of U.S. attorneys and the involvement of the White House. Now, I want your audience and yourself to remember those transfixing days in the spring and summer of 1973 when John Dean, former White House counsel, was recounting chapter and verse of his personal conversations with President Nixon to the Senate Watergate Committee. And
he had Harriet Meyer's job.
Yeah, and President Nixon didn't have the audacity to tell John Dean, you can't talk. And Nixon was not reluctant to assert executive power. And, of course, that's one of the ways in which checks and balances prevents lawlessness and abuse, because President Nixon was ultimately exposed as complicit in the Watergate cover-up and forced from office.
And so this guy's gone even beyond Nixon.
That, you know, they can tell anybody they want. You got to shut up the Congress. Don't reveal our abuses.
Yeah, we're talking with Bruce Fein, a constitutional scholar, lawyer, international consultant. The website, AmericanFreedomAgenda.org. Bruce, you can stick around over the break. We'll continue talking about this.
Certainly.
Great. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program on Air America Radio, 16 minutes past the hour. Stick around.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
Now hush. Don't say a word.
Oh, it's the NSA man song.
It's enough to know my words are being heard. And we're fighting freedom here at home. So we don't have to fight it over there. Now my own sweet Marie never listens to me. Not my brother or even my mama.
My mama.
But when they're on the line, I know you hear me one. Take that, Osama.
Wow.
Won't you please tell Condoleezza extra cheese.
Yes, please tell Condoleezza I ordered extra cheese, Mr. NSA man. Welcome back. 22 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Bruce Fein is with us, a constitutional scholar, lawyer, international consultant with Bruce Fein and Associates in the Litchfield Group. He also runs AmericanFreedomAgenda.org. And has been affiliated with conservative think tanks like the American Enterprise Institute, the Heritage Foundation, writes a weekly column for the Washington Times and Politico.com, and was the author of the first articles of impeachment against former President Bill Clinton. And Bruce Fein, yesterday, George W. Bush signed a brand new executive order. It's titled Blocking Property of Certain Persons Who Threaten Stabilization Efforts in Iraq. And it says that any conspiracy formed to violate any of the prohibitions set forth in this order is prohibited. In other words, if you and I have a conversation about doing what this order prohibits, that we can be, we're violators of this. And what we would have a conversation about, this is item B, is you are guilty if the president, with consultation, not with Congress, not even with the judiciary, but with the Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense, if the President or the Secretary of the Treasury, in consultation with the Secretary of State and the Secretary of Defense, determine that you and I are conspiring to, quote, undermine efforts to promote economic reconstruction and political reform in Iraq. So if you and I get to, and if they determine that we are doing that, they can seize all of our assets. They can freeze our checking accounts. They can stop our credit cards. They can take all our, they can seize our homes. They can take everything. We are immediately rendered, for all practical purposes, non-persons. If you and I simply have a conversation that they believe is going to harm political reform in Iraq, this is so broad and sweeping. Is it not, or am I being paranoid here?
No, I think that could reach conversations critical of the current government in Iraq, conversations saying that it's hopeless to think that the United States can succeed in transforming 4,000 years of despotism into a democracy in the next 6 months. Anything that they would say would undermine the morale of those who are hoping to build Iraq into a democracy in a day could be held to impair or undermine the reconstruction effort and therefore be illegal. It's a little bit like some of our laws during World War I that said if you criticized the war and therefore made persons less likely to accept the draft, then you are guilty of a crime. And Eugene Debs went to prison for many years for such a crime, ultimately commuted by Warren G. Harding. But this is something that, again, is vastly too broad. It sits as a sort of Damocles over all critics of the administration's Iraqi war follies. and is exemplary of this administration's ideas that if you suppress and deter dissent, then you will prevail. That's shown to be false, but they don't learn anything. They're like the French Bourbons. They forget nothing and learn nothing.
Yeah. Bruce Fein, I consider you a conservative in the kind of classic mold of Barry Goldwater, and I'm just curious why your colleagues, your friends at the American Enterprise Institute, the Heritage Foundation, the Washington Times, for that matter, why they are so resistant to an idea that you are not just embracing but promoting, which is using the threat, if not the actual tool of impeachment against George Bush and Dick Cheney to restore constitutional governance to the United States.
I think there are a couple reasons. One, maybe you're a little bit too broad. I know Norman Ornstein, a friend of mine at American Enterprise Institute, supports what I'm doing. And I've got other colleagues like David Keene of the American Conservative Union, Richard Vigory, who is a strong Reagan supporter, and Bob Barr, who I work with to impeach President Clinton, on board, as well as some others. But there is a very poisonous polarization of politics in the nation, and it's thought by many that to do anything that would help the Democrats politically is worse than anything that Bush or Cheney could do. They are not persuaded by the worry that if Hillary Clinton is in the White House in 2009, these powers could be utilized to beat and brutalize their own political adherents. The mindset of those who are in Washington is generally no more than 3 or 4 hours beyond the current time. Anything longer than that is something they'll worry about tomorrow, like Scarlett O'Hare in Gone with the Wind. And I think that explains the reticence to criticize what are clearly preposterous assertions of power that are beyond anything even imagined by King George III.
Yeah. In other words, this president has exceeded King George III in his assertions of power.
Let me just give one example for your
audience. We'll have to do it right after the break because we've got to take a break right here at the bottom of the hour. But I definitely want to hear that example. And I also wanted to ask you if a failure to convict him, either of these guys in the Senate, would mean that they're immune from future prosecution because of double jeopardy. So if you can put those thoughts in your bonnet and you can stick around with us over the break, right?
Yeah.
Great. Bruce Fein with us. The website, AmericanFreedomAgenda.org. It's the Tom Hartman Program on Air America. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Thanks. Thirty-four minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. By the way, head over to airamerica.com, click on the Tom Hartman page, and participate in our blog if you'd like. It'll put you in the running for a free copy of my new book. Actually, it's new out in paperback. It's titled Screwed, the Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. And we will be passing along a copy to one of our bloggers today, one of the folks who posts a blog over at airamerica.com on the Tom Hartman page. It actually says Louise Hartman's blog when you get to it, so check it out. Bruce Fein is with us, a constitutional scholar, an attorney, chairman of the American Freedom Agenda, AmericanFreedomAgenda.org, an organization devoted to restoring checks and balances and protections against government abuse. He served in the Justice Department during the Reagan administration as general counsel of the FCC and has been affiliated with conservative think tanks such as American Enterprise Institute, the Heritage Foundation, and writes a weekly column for the Washington Times and Politico.com. Bruce, you were about to make a point before we went to break, and then I wanted to ask you this double jeopardy question. I got a whole bunch of other questions here, too, so fire away.
All right. This perhaps is the high water mark of the monarchical-like thinking of Bush-Cheney. They assert that all of the world, including every square inch of the United States, is a battlefield, and therefore they can order the military of the United States to shoot a rocket, throw hand grenades, to use AK-47s, to kill anybody they think is al-Qaeda or al-Qaeda affiliated. If that decision is erroneous, that's collateral damage. But what their theory of the current war of terrorism is about is making where you are sitting and I am standing a battlefield where the military can come in and shoot and destroy if they have some ground that they say suggest we're implicated with Al-Qaeda. That is a frightening exercise of military jurisdiction beyond anything conceived of any previous ruler of all of the world, including Julius Caesar. Now, with regard to double jeopardy, no, impeachment and conviction in the Senate, removal from office, is not a criminal punishment in the eyes of the Founding Fathers. After removal, anyone, president, vice president, would still be vulnerable to criminal prosecution. You may recall that's the reason why President Ford pardoned Richard Nixon, because he was vulnerable to indictment by then Special Prosecutor Leon Jaworski.
Right, but he had not been impeached. I thought an impeachment and a trial in the Senate, I mean, if you have a trial in the Senate, even if he's exonerated, and apparently he would be right now, I mean, if they can't get enough votes to stop the war in Iraq, I don't think they could get enough votes for impeachment in the Senate. Or for removal from office, let's say, excuse me. But even if he's exonerated in the Senate, as Bill Clinton was, isn't he?
No, that's not.
Isn't that considered
jeopardy,
a trial?
No. Double jeopardy is viewed as jeopardy twice for a criminal prosecution. Impeachment is not viewed as a criminal prosecution, and therefore you can do a second time.
Okay, well, that's great to know. I've been saying on this program for some time now that I support impeachment of Bush and Cheney, not because I think that they're bad guys, although I do, not because I think that they've done terrible things, although I do, and certainly not for political reasons. That would be a travesty, in my opinion. But because I don't see any other way, barring some really dramatic action by Congress, like defunding the office of the president and the vice president, I don't see any other way to roll back these clear and blatant violations of the Constitution that these guys have undertaken. Are there other remedies, in your opinion, Bruce Fein?
Well, there are potential remedies if they would obey the laws that are passed. But remember, President Bush insists that he can sign a bill and then ignore the parts that he says are unconstitutional. And so that makes some of the remedies that Congress might undertake rather futile. But there are some measures that can be done, short of impeachment, that would be helpful. Congress can, by statute, eliminate military commissions. Congress can use the power of the purse to prevent any spying on us that's contradictory to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Congress can use the power of the purse to prevent any utilization of the executive power to identify people as terrorists based on secret evidence. So there certainly is sufficient authority in Congress, if they wish to exert it, to correct or to corral in many of the abuses. The problem is Congress hasn't been willing to undertake that kind of aggressiveness and been rather timid and more like spectators watching rather than performing their constitutional role of oversight.
Doesn't this imply, Bruce Fein, that Congress doesn't understand the issue in the context that you and I are describing it, and rather they're concerned that either they think that an impeachment proceeding would be a political event, or they're concerned that it would be perceived as one?
Yes, I think I'm up there every day in Congress, and the ignorance that the typical member has about the constitutional philosophy and checks and balances is staggering and stunning, probably less than a high school student who can pass a civics test. So they do not appreciate how their role is being reduced to wallpaper. And other than having an occasional appearance on C-SPAN, they decide virtually nothing of importance because the president is asserting the prerogatives of the legislative branch, the judicial, and the executive branch all at once. And they do, because of this shallowness, think, well, if we attack the president, we'll be seen as partisan. I think this is the attitude of Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, and we might lose our majority in 2008 because if we're viewed as partisan and weak on terrorism and go after Bush for his abuse, at least if he wraps himself in a patriotic flag. We don't know really how to describe the menace he's creating to the Constitution, and therefore we just better be silent.
To a certain extent, this seems to track back, in my mind, to the 1980s. During the 1980s, there was a concerted effort by people who at least call themselves conservatives to go after public school textbooks, particularly civics textbooks, and teachers, particularly unionized teachers, who were teaching American history and civics in our schools. Reagan, for all practical purposes, suspended enforcement of the Sherman Antitrust Act. The publication of school books was consolidated in the hands of basically two corporations, both of them in Texas, that print the majority of school books in the United States now. And civics was turned into memorize the date rather than understand the nature of this country as this this sort of, you know, political correctness swept the nation, all this fear and hysteria that, that civics teachers and American history teachers were talking about folks like Joe Hill, you know, or the Wobblies or whatever. And now with No Child Left Behind, again, you know, it's even getting worse. We have, and it continues. I mean, David Horowitz is trying to do the same thing now on college campuses. We have a generation. This is larger than just Congress. I mean, we've got members of Congress who never studied civics in high school or in college, and we have an entire generation of people who don't understand these fundamental issues we're discussing. How do we fix that problem, and what makes you think that impeachment of Bush and Cheney will be perceived in a more constitutional context than Congress, for example, trying to defund some of the more egregious offenses that they're committing against the Constitution?
Well, I can't be overly optimistic, but I won't be pessimistic either. Sometimes the American people surprise you, but there is no guarantee. Impeachment can be used as a schoolroom for understanding the Constitution and why the president and vice president need to be removed because they can't be trusted with the exercise of presidential prerogatives, but it might not be, depending upon how the members themselves behave. I think the problem you've identified is the correct one. It isn't just limited to Congress because they're a proxy of the general population, neither better nor worse, generally speaking, not if anything, worse. But this long-term deterioration of understanding the Constitution stems back perhaps at least 50 years, if not more, and it's continued whether the administration has been Democrat or Republican in the White House or in Congress. There's no longer even children who are instructed to read. You know, they do video games. They are on the Internet, but they don't understand and they don't take advantage of the opportunity to master, you know, the great philosophers and theorists who gave us liberty and freedom from the grasp of tyranny and feudalism. And unless you have a society that rewards and gives social esteem to people who appreciate these values and urge their enactment and retention, that they appreciate more Britney Spears or Mike Tyson or Kobe Bryant, this country is in the institutional system for diffusing and exercising power. It's not any isolated instance of wrongdoing like Clinton's perjury or obstruction. And with Andy Johnson, it really was a congressional abuse. They punished him for asking whether or not he was being correct in his understanding that he had authority to remove the Secretary of War. With regard to these other European countries, they have kept their civil liberties in many respects because their executive authorities are far less than our President of the United States. They have parliamentary systems. Parliamentary systems are collective decision-making. Moreover, they don't have global responsibilities that end up in running warfare that automatically increases dramatically the authority of the chief executive. That's why James Madison said, we need to make it difficult to go to war because the executive will inflate danger because the war always increases his power. With regard to the third question, could you repeat it quickly?
Sure, yeah. I've had a number of legislators on who say,
oh,
you know, we don't
okay,
want
I understand that.
Constitutional
the fact
crisis.
Is, we undertook the impeachment of Nixon, and we ran the legislative process simultaneously. We can chew gum and walk at the same time. We've shown that in prior impeachment proceedings. There is no, there, as you point out, the real danger is that we let our Constitution collapse and say it's more important to think about a minimum wage or school vouchers than getting the Constitution right. If that's the attitude we have, the Constitution will collapse and all these other issues will become irrelevant.
Yeah, and become secondary. Very, very well said. Bruce Fine, I want to thank you so much for sharing as much time as you have with us today.
Thank you so much.
It's Bruce Fine. The website is AmericanFreedomAgenda.org. Bruce Fine, a constitutional scholar, lawyer, international consultant with Bruce Fine and Associates, and the Litchfield Group, also writes for the Washington Times and Politico.com. It's 45 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman radio program here on Air America Radio. We'll be picking up your calls right after this. Stick around.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Attention Air America listeners. The complete MP3 archive of almost every Air America show ever broadcast is now open and free to everyone. But it only contains shows that are no longer available from Premium. To get the most recent shows, you will still need to subscribe to Premium. For details, visit airamericaplace.com/archive.
Now back to the Tom Hartman Program on airamericaradio.com.
The call is out across the land, the impeachment of Bush. For crimes and lies, you'd like to see him kicked out on his push. Friends, you've got good reason. I support you absolutely. But this impeachment season, don't forget your civic duty. Impeach Cheney first. It can still get worse. After Bush is in cuffs, it's liable to get rough. Impeach Cheney first.
He's gone over the line, I'm telling you. 51 minutes past the hour. By the authority vested in me as president, by the Constitution and the laws of the United States of America, including the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, the National Emergencies Act, and Section 301 of Title III U.S. Code, I, George W. Bush, President of the United States. Now, see, he's evoking emergency acts. He's stating that we're in the midst of a national emergency. I don't see a national emergency. Is this any different than when Germany had the Bader-Meinhof gang running around, or when Italy had the Red Brigades, or when England had the IRA? I mean, you know, so you've got some terrorists. Is that enough to shut down government and change the fundamental nature of our government? I, George W. Bush, President of the United States, this is his finding from yesterday, his executive order, find that due to the unusual and extraordinary threat to the national security and foreign policy of the United States posed by acts of violence threatening the peace and stability of Iraq! Of Iraq! And undermining efforts to promote economic reconstruction and political reform in Iraq. Therefore, all property and interests in property of the following persons that are in the United States, that hereafter come within the United States, or that are hereafter come within the possession or control of the United States persons, are blocked and may not be transferred, paid, or exported, withdrawn, or otherwise dealt in. Any person determined by the Secretary of the Treasury in consultation with the Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense to have undermined efforts to promote economic reconstruction and political reform in Iraq, or any conspiracy form to violate any of the prohibitions set forth in this order. He goes on to say, prior notion to such persons, in other words, telling them, would render these measures ineffectual. I therefore determine that there need be no prior notice of a listing or determination made pursuant to Section 1 of this order. In other words, he can simply take your home, your checking account, your freeze your credit cards, boom, suddenly you become a non-person and you're not even warned. If George Bush in his infinite wisdom decides that you are talking with somebody, conspiring, to undermine, what the hell does that word mean, to undermine political reform in Iraq? Eric in Manhattan. Hey, Eric, what's up?
Hi, Tom. You were talking about the difficulty of getting a conviction if Bush or Cheney were brought on impeachment charges. And I frankly can't imagine that they would stand trial in the Senate. Wouldn't they resign first?
I think not. I think these guys have so much hubris. You know, the Republicans were running around saying that Bill Clinton was full of hubris when he decided that he would stand for trial in the Senate. They expected him to resign after he was impeached in the House. He didn't. He said, you know, this is not that big a deal and I'm going to win. And he won by one vote, but he won. I suspect that Bush and Cheney would try to tough it out. I would be amazed if they didn't. I don't think that they have the sense of propriety that Richard Nixon had. He realized that what he had done was wrong.
The only thing that's been keeping them afloat, though, is that they can change the subject on a dime. And if they were brought up on impeachment, that would focus the public's attention like a laser beam.
It would. It would. And that's why I think it should happen. Eric, thank you for the call. Les in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Les.
Hey, Tom. I didn't know if you knew about Nancy Pelosi's impeachment site. Her website.
I know that there are people who are putting together petitions and things to send to Nancy Pelosi, and that on her website go ahead.
She has a website. It is B as in Bush, C as in Cheney, impeach.com.
That's not Nancy Pelosi's site.
Well, that's what it said.
Huh. BCimpeachment.com. I'll check it out.
It's BC Impeach, not impeachment, impeach.com.
Okay. Hang on just a second here. bcimpeach.com. All right. Let me check it out, and I will get back with you on that. 1-866-303-2270, and Mike in Syracuse, New York. Hey, Mike.
Tom, thank you.
Yeah. Okay, by the way, I'm looking at bcimpeach.com, and I guarantee you this is not Nancy Pelosi's site. Go ahead, Mike.
No, I just want to say thank you. I'm 60 years old. I've listened to talk radio for many, many years. That last interview we had was the most inspiring, best interview I've ever heard.
Well, thank you. And
keep it up, please.
Okay, you got it. Thanks a lot, Mike. Good to hear from you. Michael in Los Angeles, California. Hey, Michael.
Hey.
Got about a minute here before we wrap up this hour.
Okay. I sent you a letter a few weeks ago with a CD, and it was about when the Republicans complain about comparisons to Hitler and how they say that you've lost your argument. But at this point, I'm reluctant to say that I've lost an argument when I do the comparison. I mean, one of the problems with the Treaty of Versailles for one of the good things for Hitler was that the Treaty of Versailles limited the army to 100,000, and Hitler therefore got 500,000 brown shirts. Now the same thing is happening
right.
in Iraq.
He created his own private army. In other words, they were not members of the regular army.
Yeah.
He created his own Blackwater, basically.
Yeah. Dangerous.
And that's what Bush is doing. And guess what? They're showing up in New Orleans and maybe, you know, soon coming to a town near you. We really need to go back to being a nation of checks and balances, of constitutional limits on the power of the executive. We have gone. Bruce Fine made the point that even Julius Caesar never claimed as much power as Bush has.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio. To the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
So how are we going to bring about a true reform of a truly broken system? The worst, the most badly broken system of all the industrialized countries in the world for providing health care to its citizens. One of the essential elements of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, like at the core of life. State Senator Sheila Kuehl in California, Senate District 23, which represents West Los Angeles, Beverly Hills, that area, has introduced Senate Bill number 840 into the Senate in Sacramento, the California Senate, that would propose a single-payer program. First of all, Sheila Kuehl, Senator Kuehl, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Really happy to be here.
Great to have you here. By the way, did I watch you as a kid as Zelda on the Dobie Gillis show?
If you're very old, you could have watched me as a kid.
I am, and I did.
Yes, we did that show. It was great childhood.
That's great. That's marvelous. Well, in any case, I'm pleased to have you on the program. Yesterday, we were talking on the air about this Wall Street Journal article and, you know, big front page story yesterday about how Arnold Schwarzenegger is taking on the Democrats with these dueling programs that would both leave all the health insurance companies intact. And I describe health insurance companies by and large. I mean, I don't want to ban them or outlaw them or anything. I think that if we had single payer health care, they would still find a niche, but it would be a much, much smaller niche. But it seems to me that with their current status, they're kind of a leech on the back of society. And my words, not yours, I know. And that single-payer health care is really the way to go. You have proposed this in California. Do I have that right?
Yes. It's just like Medicare for all Californians and would be paid for pretty much the same way, only in California, of course. Mm-hmm. Would cover all California residents. It would provide a great panoply of coverage, virtually everything anybody thinks of as healthcare, you know, doctors, hospitals, plus dental, vision, pharmaceuticals, durable goods. And then everybody would pay one premium, one total premium a year, no copays, no deductibles. Employers would also pay one premium a year. And the government would continue to cover poor people as it does now, both the feds and the state. And all that money would be disseminated by a central insurance system the way Medicare works.
Right. And any sense of how much that premium would be?
Well, the total amount of money that we spent last year in California on health care, government money real people money, employer money, was about $186 billion, which is about twice our state budget. And so figuring that that is potentially the appropriate amount of money, but you have to spread it out over everybody, we figured it would be about 7.5% on employers' payrolls, not counting the first $7,000 of each person's salary. So if you were paying on your employees and they made, you know, $35,000, you'd pay 7.5 on $28,000. Mm-hmm. Plus, working people would pay about 3.5% of their income. But no copays, no deductibles takes the place of all premiums. So actually, virtually everybody paying anything for health care would save money.
Right, because right now we're all paying for this anyway. We're paying it, you know, and some of us, our employers are deducting it. Some of us, we're sharing it with our employers. Some of us are just buying it ourselves, and a lot of us are just not insured. And but we're all paying it for the people who are not insured with taxes, because they show up at emergency rooms for $500 procedures that should have been a $35 hospital or a doctor visit, rather.
Right, and add to that primary care and preventive care, which everybody would get because everybody would have a primary care physician. You actually save a lot of money there. You catch the diabetes before it's diabetes, et cetera.
Right. Right. We would also save money because the insurance companies are not going to be siphoning anywhere from 20% to 30% off the top to pay dividends to their stockholders, the multimillion-dollar salaries to their CEOs, pay for the private jets and the gold-plated bathrooms they're in.
Well, not only that, but they're just their administrative costs, and not only them, but the docs and the hospitals, too, because, you know, when you go in to see a doc, you don't see the doctor, you don't even see the nurse, you see the computer person. They have to make sure you're insured, you're still insured, you're still working for the same guy, he's still got the same insurance, you're insured for this doctor who's in the network maybe today, you know. And so a lot of money is wasted on these administrative overhead. We limit ours to 5%, but the estimate is we could do it for 3%.
Right, which is what Medicare does it for.
Plus, if you buy all the pharmaceuticals through one system, you get a heck of a good price. Which is the way, you know, Medicare does it. Well, actually, they don't do it, actually. President Bush didn't want anyone negotiating for prices.
Right.
So
but it's the way the VA does
trail
it,
there, too.
Yeah, it's the way the VA does it. So this is a single-payer health care system. Now, I understand that you introduced this in the last legislative session. It actually passed, and the governor vetoed it. Do I have that right?
That's right, yeah. Governor Schwarzenegger, who, incidentally, unlike what you said or what the Wall Street Journal said, doesn't have a plan or a bill. He has a sort of a spoken proposal.
He has a soundbite.
Yeah, well, exactly. He never made it into a bill. The two Democratic leaders in the Senate and the House here put their bill together. So there is an actual proposal, but as you did say, it keeps the insurance companies in place.
Sheila, one of the big problems that I see with this, for some reason, probably because we do a nationally syndicated talk show here, and are on the air from Los Angeles to New York every day.
Uh-huh.
U.S. News and World Report started showing up free here. And to the address that's on our website is our contact address here at Clear Channel in Portland, Oregon. And this week's issue, the July 23 through 30 issue, it is entirely about our healthcare system. And the top is America's Best Hospitals, exclusive rankings, top care in 16 specialties, plus a complete guide to managing your hospital stay. It's cheerleading for the current medical system. And Louise went through this thing and counted 52 full-page ads. That's 80% to 90% of all the ads in this magazine, in a 126-page magazine. 52 of them are from the health industry, shall we say. And we look at their rate card here for U.S. News and World Report, and a full-page four-color ad is it goes up to $147,000 if you're buying the national issue. That's $7.8 million that the healthcare industry, presumably, assuming that these people were paying something close to the rate card, over $7 million that U.S. News and World Report made on this one issue of this magazine that is cheerleading that industry. How do you deal with that? You're proposing something that's going to take a bite out of the profits of all of the advertisers, of the majority of the advertisers, in this issue of U.S. News and World Report. How do you deal with a media that is now funded by an industry that is destroying the health of America?
Well, it's very interesting to me, Tom, that that's a fairly new phenomenon. I mean, you did not see this many ads for pharmaceuticals or for health systems, even just 4 or 5 years ago.
Right.
Although they're spending an enormous amount on marketing, the interesting thing, of course, the ironic thing is they market to you, but they won't take you if you ever even had a yeast infection or anything. You know, they'll turn you down for insurance. So it's all right. Kind of a smoke and mirrors thing. Anyway.
I think they're spending all this money in order to buy favorable editorial coverage, or at least to buy media not running negative editorial coverage.
Right. Well, I mean, even Catholic Healthcare West, which is a group of hospitals in California and a few other Western states, has been taking full-page ads in the Los Angeles Times, and that's fairly pricey, too, just to put a sentence in the middle that says Catholic Healthcare West really supports some kind of reform in healthcare.
Well, so,
of course, hospitals are going under because they're not even getting paid adequately by the insurance companies.
Right. I would think for a hospital, probably not, maybe not for a for-profit hospital, but maybe so, because you're not suggesting socialized medicine where the government actually buys the hospitals
No.
and employs the doctors. You're just saying the insurance company.
Right,
the
like
state.
Medicare. And actually,
right.
Quite the opposite. In my plan in California, you would be under the California insurance system. You could go to any doctor, any hospital. You wouldn't
right.
be limited the way you are by insurance companies to only doctors that are in your network or, you know, and they go in and out. I mean, poor doctors get dropped by a network and they don't get to see their patients anymore.
Sure. We're talking with State Senator Sheila Kuehl. She is the primary author of or whatever.
That's
what
right.
would you call it?
It's
sponsor
author.
Of. Senate Bill 840. And Senator Kuehl, we just have about a half a minute here left. What can our listeners in California do to help you get this bill passed? And what can our listeners all across the country do to try and get similar legislation in their states?
Well, I think the first thing would be to go to my website. Last name is spelled K-U-E-H-L, and it's Sheila Kuehl. It's the first thing that comes up on Google. Because we've got lots of information about 840 action items, how to get involved. Anyone across the country can do that. Get an idea of what we're doing here, and then see if they can't get it started in their states.
Okay, great. And that's senate.ca.gov/KUEHL as well.
Right, but if you just Google my name, it's the first thing that comes up.
Google Sheila Kuehl, and then you can find out what you can do in your state as well.
Yes.
Good on you.
Good on you.
Congratulations.
Tom, thanks.
Thank you. Great to hear from you, Senator. I wish you the very best. Please keep us up to date on this, and if there are any updates or any news events around it, let us know. We'll put you back on the air.
Will do, thanks.
Much appreciated. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news. This is Air America Radio.
This here's a land of plenty, and plenty is what it takes to get some health insurance in these old United States. I shouldn't have to go bankrupt or on the street. If the cancer comes a-calling, as it might for you or me. I ran into my congressman, said, "Your Honorable, would you mind taking 20 minutes, if you ever find the time, to figure out some health care that would work as good for me as what you fellas got yourself in Washington, D.C.? So if you get appendicitis or a splinter in your hand, I hope you're in New Zealand, Libya, or Switzerland, or somewhere else where they have somehow figured out a way to keep you upright till the good Lord says that it's your day."
Hey. 21 minutes past the hour. By the way, a special call out to our friends listening on WTKG in Grand Rapids. I'll be there at the end of this week. I'll be there Friday, broadcasting live from the Celebration Cinema North. Friday, July 20th. Look forward to meeting you. And we're also going to be doing a book signing at Schuller's. It's going to be short because right after that, it's at 7 p.m., Schuller's Bookstore in Grand Rapids. And because right after that is the Harry Potter book is coming out. So it's going to be but I will be there and I'll be shaking hands and I'll be giving a short talk. And it's going to be a great presentation. You get all the information over at WTKG.com if you're in the North or West Michigan area, Central Michigan area, Kent County or environs. Here I have this issue of U.S. News and World Report, July 23 to 30, America's Best Hospitals. What happened to the days when we did investigative reporting and the headline said America's Worst Hospitals? Isn't it the job of the press to tell us what to look out for, not to be cheerleaders for their advertisers? I mean, I know U.S. News and World Report has always been considered a conservative publication, or at least I've always considered it a conservative publication. The conservative bias has always been fairly conspicuous, in my mind, in their reporting. But this is over the top. I mean, this is incredible. Here, you turn to page 7. and Zetia, ezetimibe tablets. Get the story on a different way to lower cholesterol. This is a two-page ad. A full four-color bleed, $166,216 a shot. So this is over a $300,000 ad. That's pages 6 and 7. Page 8, a full-page four-color bleed for the Portland Clinic. I mean, it goes page 21, looking for good blood sugar control. Another, bleed means that the color runs all the way to the edge of the page. You have to pay extra for that because it goes into the trim and you know, it's requires a little extra work. Exubera, a full-page ad for that. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. You have a page 41, Vitorin, treats the two sources of cholesterol. Two-page ad. We just moving along, Walden University. Imagine what Dr. You. Well, even medical school, page 45. Page 47, an ad for Rosarem, full page, these guys have got some bucks. I'm telling you, they have got some bucks. Here, if you turn to page 52 and 53, full page two, this is a double truck, a full page spread for Covidin, one of the world's largest providers of advanced medical devices. Yeah, I really want to buy an MRI machine. Please send it to me. Why would a company that sells medical devices want to be advertising? In fact, they say providing innovations and partnerships to the medical community. Why buy a consumer publication? Why not buy an ad in the Journal of the American Medical Association? Well, could it be that maybe it's good policy? Maybe it guarantees good editorial coverage. Full-page ad for the American Heart Association, American Stroke Association. I mean, it just goes on and on. Flomax, page 59, full-page ad. Want to take more time grilling steaks and less time on bathroom breaks? Sounds nice. Here's a full-page ad for the AMA. The American Medical Association. This is on page 63. This patient thinks she's healthy. A doctor would tell her she's not. Yeah, well, then, AMA, why do you limit the number of people who can go to medical schools? Why don't we have a system like they have in Cuba, where anybody who can qualify for medical school can go to a medical school? They have so many doctors in Cuba, and again, I'm not saying we should become like Cuba, but this policy of saying we're going to limit the supply of doctors to drive up the price of their services, this is nuts. Cuba has so many doctors, they're exporting them. They're giving them away. Countries all over Central and South America, even in Africa. I ran across Cuban doctors in Kenya back in the 80s. I mean, you find Cuban doctors all over the world helping out. Why can't we be doing the same? I'll tell you, the vast majority of people I know in medicine, and one of my very best friends from college is a physician. He actually just retired as a urologist, a kidney surgeon. I have known a bunch of docs over the years as friends. I mean, obviously as a patient as well. I mean, all of us have seen the doctor at one time or another, but none of them, not one of these people, including my friend Steve, who even, you know, went into a fairly high paid specialty. None of them went into it for the money. By and large, in fact, I don't want to be treated by a doctor who went to medical school for the money. I want to be treated by a doctor who went into medicine because it was his calling. I certainly want him to be well paid. But limiting the supply of doctors so that we can have oncologists making millions and millions of dollars. Come on! We've got a system that is broken from the top to the bottom, through and through. It's time to change it. It's time to fix it. 866-303-2270, our number, TomHartman.com for our live chat room, 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
How extraordinary that Justice Antonin Scalia, the right-winger Scalia, was willing to do something that many of the majority of Democrats in the House of Representatives are afraid to do. speak up against George Bush's theft of human rights and destruction of the Constitution. Believe it or not, this was the case of Hamdi versus Rumsfeld. This was a couple of years ago, by the way. Antonin Scalia wrote, "The founders warned us about the risk and equipped us with a constitution to deal with it." What was the risk he was talking about? He quoted Alexander Hamilton from Federalist Number 8, who said, now this is Alexander Hamilton now I'm quoting, but it's Scalia quoted him in the decision. "The violent destruction of life and property incident to war, the continual effort and alarm attendant on a state of continual danger, will compel nations the most attached to liberty to resort to repose and security, to institutions which have a tendency to destroy their civil and political rights. To be more safe, they, at length, become willing to run the risk of being less free." Scalia continued, after quoting Hamilton, "In the Hamdan versus Rumsfeld case, he said, many think it not only inevitable but entirely proper that liberty give way to security in times of national crisis. But that view has no place in the interpretation and application of a constitution designed precisely to confront war and, in a matter that accords with democratic principles, to accommodate it." How ironic that Justice Scalia was willing to stand up to George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, and Alberto Gonzalez, but most of the House and Senate Democrats won't. Although, you know, to give them credit, they did stand up last night about the war in Iraq, but, you know, we'll see where it goes from here. The bottom line. Well, in fact, we just, this email from Greg, I don't know if he wants his last name used, so I won't, but he says, "While listening to your program today regarding Bush's recent signings, declaring a national emergency and allowing the government the right to withhold your personal assets if the administration believes that you are undermining the reconstruction or normalization of Iraq and its newly elected government, does this mean that if our own Congress decides to eliminate the funding for the troops in order to end the war, that each and every one of them can lose all their assets by such an act?" Yes, it does, legally. You'll recall that, I don't even want to go into parallels with Hitler. It's low-hanging fruit. The bottom line, first, Bush, Cheney, and Gonzalez came for the terrorists, but I was not a terrorist, so I did not speak out. Then they came for the enemy combatants, but I was not an enemy combatant, so I didn't object. Then they came for the protesters resisting free speech zones near campaign rallies and speeches, but I was not a protester, so I only voiced my unease. And now, in yesterday's executive order, Bush may be coming for you and me. We need national health care. We need our we need our rights back. Or this may be the reality that we experience.
So, all those clowns over at the liberal radio network, we could incarcerate them immediately. Will you have that done, please? Send over the FBI and just put them in chains?
Thank you, Mr. O'Reilly. Very reassuring. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. TomHartmann.com, by the way, if you want to drop into the to our live chat room. And AirAmerica.com, if you want to participate in our blog today. Art in Marysville, Washington. Hey, Art, what's up? And then Art's not there. Stacy in Indiana. Hey, Stacy, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Hey, I'm sitting here every day doing bookkeeping. My husband and I own a small newspaper in Indiana. Mm-hmm. We have four people total, including me and him, and I work like 80 to 100 hours a week. I sit here through this bookkeeping, and I listen to, you know, all of you guys during the day, and I feel like a liberal to the heart, but I can't figure out how a policy like the California rep was just talking about, how that wouldn't just kill us as a small business, because we have a very limited market, and they're all small business owners too, and I can't figure out how we would, you know, we couldn't raise our ad rates. I mean, our ad...
Are you paying for health insurance for your employees?
Yeah, and we don't have any right now. And my husband, you know, neither one of us...
Are you paying for health insurance for yourself?
We pay an emergency $250 a month emergency medical for us and our two kids. And, right, you know, that's not easy on us either right there. So, and we rent. We still rent. And, you know, I mean, we've won First Amendment you know, awards, and we work hard to, you know, hold the school right. board and town council.
If you don't mind my asking, how much is your gross annual income?
Gross?
Your family income. You know, how much of a paycheck are you taking?
Well, what our newspaper grosses is probably...
No. But how much you and your husband are taking home every year?
Like 45.
$45,000.
Yeah.
Okay, so what she's suggesting is that you, as your own employer, would have to pay 7% of that, which would be...
Well, we have to pay it on our employees, too, right? I mean,
right, but you said you don't have any.
To the FICA, and, right. So, right. I know...
But otherwise, you'd have to pay for health care for your employees, wouldn't you? Or else they would... Or
no,
else you're going to have to pay it...
Do. I mean, we just have the emergency medical that we pay just in case something bad happens right now.
No, I understand, but see... What you don't get, Stacey, is you are already paying for all those people who are not insured, even your employees who are not insured, because those folks show up in hospital emergency rooms. Those folks,
I know. We've had to do that plenty of times, and it's really,
right.
really killed us. But
and it's absurdly expensive. You're already paying for it in your taxes.
I'm trying to figure out, like, a week-to-week, but, I mean, you know, a week-to-week basis, how do we cover that? You know, I mean, we'd have to raise our rates on everything, and and our advertisers, you know, I mean, I'm afraid we'd lose advertising. We're already trying to make it with Gannett and everybody.
But if everybody in the state is in the same boat,
right?
Then it doesn't make you non-competitive.
Yeah, I mean,
it's just like when
more about the immediate, you know, 3 month period. Then I mean, I understand definitely what you're saying about the long term. And
Reagan raised the Social Security income tax.
Mm-hmm.
He doubled it in 1982, I think it was. It might have been 83.
Yeah, but still
he doubled
people
it.
That make it over 80,000 don't have to pay anything on it.
That's right. That's right. But people like you and me who pay the vast majority of their income is taxed by FICA.
Right.
That tax doubled. It went from around 5.5% or 6%, as I recall, to around 13%.
Yeah, 13%.
And half of it's paid for by the employer, half of it was paid for by the employee. And there were people who were concerned that it was going to wipe out America. And it didn't.
In fact, there was no bump in economic growth.
I mean,
it hurts really bad when you're a person that lives on accounts receivable and your accounts receivable is the next business next door to you who you know personally and you know they're struggling. So,
right.
I mean, factories are closing all over the place. People don't have jobs. And I'm talking about the 3 month period. And I want to believe in it. I want to believe
Stacey, here's one of the reasons the factories are closing all over the place, because the cost of health care through the current system where you're paying 30% profit to the healthcare insurance companies and only some people are being insured and other people are having to pay, you and I are having to pay through our taxes,
right.
$500 for somebody to go to a hospital emergency room that should have been a $30 doctor's visit. Those inefficiencies and those expenses we're all picking up, and companies are picking them up, and it's making them non-competitive. I would submit to you that
$500 extra, but I can't pay a $500 extra on the two employees also is what I'm saying without raising our rates on people. And then I'm just worried that, you know, how do we keep our business if we...
Because it happens to everybody in the state.
In the long term, it's going to be better. I totally understand that. But I'm thinking more along the lines, like, if my kid, you know, falls down outside next month or breaks his ankle, I mean... You know, one emergency visit's $2,000. I mean, every time.
That's my point, and it wouldn't be under her case, under her thing. I mean, I guess you have to determine what's the greater risk, that you or somebody in your family or one of your employees might get sick and be totally wiped out and bankrupt, and you completely lose your entire business, or that you have to hold your breath a little bit and raise your rates 2 or 3% to recover the costs of paying into a statewide health insurance program that gives you 100% coverage, no deductibles, nothing to worry about. You can go to any hospital. You can go to any doctor.
The worry off your head would just be incredible, and
yeah, it would, and that's how it would work.
People who have insurance just don't even understand what that's like, and you know the worry part of it. I mean, you constantly tell your kids, you know, don't do this and don't do that because we don't have insurance, you know. And
yeah, no, I got it, Stacey.
I think I'm most concerned about just what might happen immediately, and that part, I think, other small business owners would probably, who maybe aren't very liberal-minded anyway, would you know, be worried about the immediate effect on the state.
Sure, and just like everybody was worried about the immediate effect when Social Security taxes were increased, and you know, we got through it. It was no big deal because it affected everybody. It's just like, you know, people say, oh, well, we should have, you know, the taxes cut by 20%. Well, you cut taxes by 20% right across the board for everybody in America. Everybody thinks they're going to have 20% more in their paycheck. But what happens, and go back and look at what happened during the Reagan era, when taxes actually did, actually on the middle class, by and large, taxes weren't decreased that much, but they were decreased slightly. What happened was pay went down. Because employers are going, okay, I'm paying this guy $50,000 a year, and he's taking home $35,000 a year after taxes. So now he's taking home $40,000 a year taxes after taxes. So instead of paying him $50,000 a year, I'll pay him $47,000 a year, so he's still taking home $35,000 a year, because I know that's what he'll work for. That's how employers think. That's the calculus that's done. You got to get it. The taxes are like this thing that operates in the background. When they're applied to everybody, they don't distort markets at the individual and unique level the way that you're concerned about, Stacey. They really don't. Look at history. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Nine and a half minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. By the way, I'm in Leonardo DiCaprio's new movie, The 11th Hour. The trailer is up at the top of our website, tomhartman.com. Check it out. It's a YouTube video. You can click on it and you can see the Warner Brothers trailer. It's coming to a theater near you. They're going to be releasing the thing next month. And we're going to be getting more and more involved with that and talking more about it because it's an extraordinary, extraordinary movie. 1-866-303-2270, our toll-free number all across the United States and around the world. TomHartman.com for our live chat room. AirAmerica.com for our blog. Frank in Middleton, New York. Hey, Frank, what's up?
Well, you know, I and various others over the last year.
Frank, your phone is really, really, you know, scrambled and broken up. I'm sorry. I don't know if it's a bad cell phone or what, but it just is not working. Anthony in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Anthony.
Hi, Tom. Couple things. I wanted to kind of go back to this. I don't know if you want to call it executive privilege or attorney-client privilege that Harriet.
Well, Bush is calling it executive privilege, but even Nixon didn't have the audacity to do that. He allowed John Dean, his attorney, to testify before Congress.
And so basically, I just had kind of two things, and I don't know if I heard it on your show yesterday, but I think you said, I think it was on your show that you were saying that the attorney for the Guantanamo defendants had all of his legal papers and everything confiscated.
That was Ellen Ratner told us that her brother is the director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, ccr-ny.org.
And so
not confiscated, but gone through, read.
And so is it safe to say that the defendants down in Guantanamo can't claim attorney-client privilege, or even
yes,
the attorney can't claim that for,
yes,
for
it's
their
safe
legal
to say that
stuff? But yet he is, Bush is claiming that Harriet Myers, who didn't appear by midnight last night, so I'm hoping that she goes to jail or something. I don't know.
Yeah, I am very hopeful that Congress will hold her in contempt of Congress, and I'm hopeful that they will use the inherent contempt provision, which hasn't been used since the 1930s, but is there. It's on the books. It's legal. It goes all the way back to the founding of this country. It was first used in the 1790s. I am hopeful that they will use the inherent contempt provision where they don't have to ask the Justice Department, Alberto Gonzalez, to do their work for them. They can simply say to the sergeant at arms, go get this woman, and bring her here in chains.
And so basically, finally, on the health care issue, briefly, my mother works for a prison here in Washington, and she has to pay outrageous, she's a nurse, and she has to pay outrageous amounts of copays for her medications, but yet she's giving brand name drugs, not generics, brand name drugs to the prisoners. And it's like, I mean, are we going to have to go to prison to get decent health care? I mean,
Well, that was the essence of Michael Moore's movie. You know, he took the guys from 9/11 who couldn't get health care because they've got lung disease that's ripping their lungs apart, and that's now a pre-existing condition. They couldn't get health care. He took them down to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, to say, hey, you know, you're giving great health care to these guys that you say had something to do with 9/11. Here's the 9/11 heroes. Can you give them some health care, too? And they wouldn't let him in, of course.
So, thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for the call. It's amazing. Doug in Orange County, California, listening on KLSD. Hey, Doug.
Hey, Tom. You had a great program. You're a real patriot.
Thank you.
The Saudis, you know, our allies, the Saudis.
Yeah,
you know,
our allies who are accounting for 50% of all the suicide bombers and foreign terrorists in Iraq.
You know, CNN, none of these stations picked up on it. I mean, I love Keith Olbermann, and he didn't even pick up on it. You know, nobody's doing anything about it.
The only newspaper that I could find in the United States that did any really good investigative reporting on that was the Los Angeles Times, and it was their reporter Baghdad who actually did the report that I read excerpts of it on the radio here yesterday, and their reporter in Baghdad did that report, compiled the information, and I'm guessing that probably a lot of the other news outlets didn't want to do it because they didn't, you know, they're competitive with each other, and they didn't want to say the LA Times said. And if that's the case, it's all the more tragic that the profit motive in this bizarre thing have not only brought us infotainment, but now have brought us de facto news blockades for lack of a better purpose. It's absolutely bizarre. Doug, thanks a lot for the call. Wayne in Bells, Tennessee. Hey, Wayne, listening on WSMB.
Hey, I was wondering, you had Bruce Fine on, and I heard someone else on Air America mention him, I guess, this past week, and he was also on Bill Moyers, I think.
He was, right. Along with John Nichols.
Yeah, and I was wondering, do you consider him to be just another rat deserting the GOP ship? You know, because he was part of that Clinton impeachment thing, and where was he in 2000 when Rink was practically anointed Bush the president? I mean, he's a constitutional scholar, right?
I honestly don't know, and it would have been a good question to ask him what his opinion of the Bush v. Gore case was. I know that his assertion that Clinton should be impeached had to do with, you know, Clinton broke the law, therefore he should be impeached. And frankly, I didn't want to get into that fight with him because it's old territory, and my sense of Bruce Fine, if you check out his website, and I strongly encourage you to because it's a really good one. My sense of Bruce Fine is that he's not a rat deserting the sinking ship, that he actually believes this stuff. And frankly, I think that's the case with Bob Barr as well.
I've talked about it on
a number of occasions. No, I know Bob Barr was having an affair on the side at the same time he was prosecuting Clinton and all that kind of stuff. I get that. And,
well,
you know, the guy was a
hypocrite.
Well,
why doesn't history matter now? I mean, okay, it's old history. You want to say that was old news, but, you know, you got a track record and all of a sudden you're doing a 180?
Because I think that what these guys are seeing, and they're genuinely seeing it. These are guys who actually understand the Constitution. They're seeing that the horrors that the Bush administration is perpetrating are so great that they're willing to set aside partisanship when in the past they have behaved in partisan ways.
But
what that says to me is that the situation is even worse than we thought it was.
Well, it's a little later in the day to start raising up now.
Well, yeah, we can say that, but what, you don't want them saying these things?
Well, actually, no, I don't. I mean, you're going to stand by and let everything happen up to this point?
No, I want these guys speaking out, and I think it's a good thing that they are, frankly. I am as concerned as they are about these particular issues. 57 minutes past.
The Tom Hartman Program. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio. Tune into the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Talk radio for the rest of us.
Well, you know, sometimes you know what you know, and sometimes you know what you don't know, and sometimes you don't know what you don't know, and sometimes it's, as Don Rumsfeld would say, the things that you don't know that the unknown unknowns that may even be the biggest problem, but sometimes even what you do know is wrong.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync. You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
As the Firesign Theater would say, strange things out there, but maybe there's something to them. Michelle Dresbold is with us. She is a handwriting expert and author of Sex, Lies, and Handwriting. Profile and handwriting expert has helped police solve murder, arson, and bank robbery cases. Michelle, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Thank you. And your website is Michelle, with two L's, M-I-C-H-E-L-L-E, Dresbold, D-R-E-S-B-O-L-D.com, if people want to check this out. And a lot of fascinating stuff over there. First of all, you have done an analysis of a whole bunch of people's handwriting, and some of them fascinate me. The Democratic and Republican candidates, and I want to get to those in just a minute. And also George W. Bush and Ann Coulter, an interesting combination. What does, for example, Ann Coulter's handwriting tell you?
Well, in Ann Coulter's handwriting, I talk about something in my book called Danger Signs. And there's different types of danger signs. Some people might shoot you, but what she has in her handwriting is a danger sign that shows that somebody will kill you with their tongue. They have a very sharp, biting tongue. And how you see that in handwriting is when you look at a T. If you look at how the T is crossed, if the T goes into a very narrow point, almost like a dagger, that symbolizes somebody who will cut you down verbally. She has one of the sharpest, pointiest T crossings I have ever seen. And so that's in her handwriting.
Interesting. George W. Bush.
Well, George W. Bush, what he has in his handwriting is actually another danger sign. When you see handwriting and you look at like an S and it could be a B and you cannot tell what letter is what, it's called ambiguous writing. Now, George Bush, when you look at his signature, you will notice that the G could be an S. You cannot read any letters. It's different than an illegible signature. It's a signature where the letters are actually ambiguous. And when you have that, that's somebody who will say one thing but leave himself open for interpretation at the time that's convenient for him. So that's another danger sign, actually. When you look at handwriting, and you're saying, is this a S? Is this a G? Is this a T? Like his Bush, the H just looks like an L. You cannot.
Yeah. No. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I'm just saying you cannot decipher any letters in his name.
Now I'm looking at John McCain's signature here on your website, and the M is clear in McCain, and then there's kind of a dot, and then the C seems kind of clear, and then it just kind of wanders off. It just trails off. What does that mean?
When you have handwriting and the end of it trails off, that's the end of your name. And what that means is the future to you is you don't know what's happening in the future. So when you see somebody and their handwriting just trails off at the end, they're scared about the future. They're not sure what's the next step.
Well, that's interesting. My handwriting is I tend to, just ignore the last few letters of my name. But I've never been able to say that I know what my future is going to bring. So.
Right. I think it's the same.
Yeah, Rudy Giuliani. What does his handwriting tell you?
I don't have it in front of me, but his handwriting, if I remember correctly, the upper zone, which means the top of your letters, is a little tight.
It is. It's extremely tight. In fact, the whole thing is very tight.
When you have tight handwriting, especially in the upper zone, meaning your L's, your K's, your H's, is somebody who sometimes can be very narrow-minded thinking. In fact, if you went back to Ann Coulter's handwriting, if you look at her we call it the upper zone, the top loops of any letters represents what goes on in your head. And the tighter they are and the more squished, as you might call it, the tighter the thinking and the less open-minded that person is.
Interesting. And now over on the Democratic side, I'm looking at these examples again on your website at michelledresbold.com, and John Edwards, very different from Hillary Rodham Clinton, and in fact Clinton and Hillary are broken into multiple pieces. Well, even Rodham is in Hillary Clinton's signature.
Right. Well, you'll have, it's called a print writing. That's somebody who writes half printing, half writing. They combine the most efficient use of printing and cursive. When you have that, you have a very efficient thinker whose brain is always thinking ahead.
This is Hillary Clinton's handwriting.
That's Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. Also, the thing about Hillary's handwriting is it has no extra loops or curves. It's right to the point. And that's somebody who's more like, give me the facts. And she could actually use a few more curves in her handwriting to soften her up just a little bit.
And now, are you suggesting that if I change my handwriting, my personality will change?
Yes, especially if you know what you're doing. I actually changed my handwriting to change something in my personality. For example, If you cross your T only halfway, it means you're only following through halfway in life, not reaching your goals. If you force your hand to go all the way through the T when you cross it, it means you're forcing yourself to follow through on things. So if you know what you're doing, I call it handwriting therapy. It's one of the best ways to change traits in yourself that you don't like, because you're doing a physical act to correlate with an emotional feeling.
That's interesting. Barack Obama, you have his handwriting up on your website. His first and last name are kind of all run together.
They're all run together. I found what is the most interesting thing about him is in his O, he has a symbol. I went and I looked at what that symbol could mean, and I found it to be a Greek symbol that means the golden ratio. So I think that that may be what his philosophy on life is. He actually put in, if you look in the O and look up, I think it's called phi, P-H-I, sign, mm-hmm. That's what he puts in his O.
Yeah,
and I don't know if it's conscious or subconscious. He may have seen that symbol and liked it and incorporated it into his own signature.
And John Edwards' signature.
Well, John Edwards, his signature goes way more to the right. Right, people whose handwriting slants to the right are emotional. So he goes very much with his emotions. And if you look at compare him to Hillary, Hillary's is straight up and down. That's somebody in control of all the emotions, very controlled. John Edwards, when your handwriting goes more to the right, emotionally, you're more emotional.
Now, does that mean that he would be more prone to, make an irrational/emotional decision, or does that mean that he's more in contact with his gut and has better empathy for people? I mean, he's made poverty, for example, the centerpiece of his campaign.
Well,
that for a rich guy, that requires empathy.
Right. If you're very emotional and you can use that in any way, somebody who goes with what their feelings are, their emotions are, and I think it's, you need both going with your head and your emotions. That emotion can be somebody who goes with their gut and goes with their feelings. So you want a little bit of a combination of both. And somebody who's straight up and down, they may not go with their emotions at all, just the facts. And I sometimes think you need a combination.
And I don't see Dennis Kucinich's handwriting on your website here. Have you looked at his signature?
Do you know, I have not looked at his hit signature. I will try to find it, and I'll put it on there within the
next. Okay, I'd be curious for your take on that. I see Bill Richardson you have some thoughts on.
Right. I wish I had these in front of me as we're talking, but and I don't remember exactly what I said about Bill Richardson.
You said it slants strongly to the right, and his heart rules, and I think that's the sense that we've seen in people. We have less than a minute. We're talking with Michelle Dresbold, MichelleDresbold.com, the website. Michelle, is there any actual scientific evidence that backs up the assertions that you're making here?
Well, they have studied handwriting for years and years. In fact, it's one of the oldest forensic sciences. Confucius studied it. It's been studied for years, and it's actually been used in the court systems since the 1700s. A group of
But isn't that largely for just identification, not for analysis of personality?
In court, you go just for identification. But one of the ways that handwriting or the profiling of people developed from handwriting was a group of psychiatrists got together, and they actually did studies from handwriting correlations to personality, and that went on for years.
And they found there was a correlation, and that's where this information came from.
There's a huge correlation.
That's fascinating. Michelle Dresbold, MichelleDresbold.com, the website. Michelle, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
You too. Fascinating. A little unusual, but fascinating stuff. 16 minutes past the hour. Hey, Larry Johnson with the CIA, up next.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Fighting for land and high, don't you live or die. War up some, war down some, war over slow. Everywhere is war, political wars. We're singing war.
Everywhere is war. Oh, terrible thing. Terrible thing. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you, 21 minutes past the hour. By the way, a lot of folks, we've got a number of emails here and folks asking over at the, in the, dropping into the chat room and asking and whatnot, where can I get a copy of or how can I listen to the first hour of today's program where we spent about 45 minutes talking with Bruce Fine, of formerly of the Heritage Foundation, the American Enterprise Institute, currently a columnist for the Washington Times and Politico.com, the guy who wrote the articles of impeachment against Bill Clinton. Against Bill Clinton, a constitutional scholar and attorney who has now come out and explicitly, openly, aggressively said, and did so on Bill Moyer's program last week as well, and did for 45 minutes here on this program, said, we have to impeach Bush and Cheney now. Not to punish these guys for wrongdoing, to restore constitutional government to the United States and to reduce the levels of power resident now in the executive branch, which are way beyond anything that has been seized before by any executive, including, according to Bruce Fine, King George III, against whom we fought a revolution, and Julius Caesar. I mean, even they did not assert that they could go into other countries and defy the habeas corpus right, basically snatch people off the streets and throw them in jail forever, or torture them, or murder them. Even they didn't say it. Anyhow, people have asked, where is that audio? And it's there's the full hour clip. You can hear it right now. It's up over at 620kpoj.com, which is our Portland radio station, our Portland affiliate, Portland, Oregon, where we do this show from, where I'm based here, even though it's mixed in New York and goes up to the satellite from there. And we're on the air from coast to coast. We do it out of the studios of 620KPOJ, and 620KPOJ.com is the website. Larry Johnson is with us. Larry Johnson, a former Central Intelligence Agency officer, and State Department officer with the Department of Counterterrorism and experts in the fields of terrorism, aviation security, crisis, and risk management. And his website has now changed. It's NoQuarterUSA.net. NoQuarterUSA.net. Larry Johnson, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, how are you?
Just great. Great to have you with us, Larry. You had a blog on your, or a post on your blog a couple of days ago that I thought it was one of the best that I've ever read. It was absolutely extraordinary about this whole issue of the ethnic cleansing of Baghdad and environs and how far it's gone. Give us the snapshot here of this, we've driven off the cliff post of yours.
Track what's been going on.
And what you've chronicled in this post over at NoQuarterUSA.net is that some communities in Baghdad that were 80% Sunni are now virtually entirely Shia.
Yeah,
that this
correct.
Ethnic cleansing has we're at the tail end of it now. This is like what happened in Rwanda.
Yeah, it's not quite as bloody as Rwanda with lopping people's heads and arms off, but you know, the effect is still the same. You do have, on the Shia side, you have the Mehdi army, which is aligned with Muqtada al-Sadr, and then you have the Badr Brigade, which is aligned with al-Hakim al-Aziz.
Al-Sistani?
Yeah, and it's not Sistani, but those two are fighting amongst themselves, too, so it's not entirely a peaceful situation. But
yeah. Stick around, Larry.
Okay.
If we can continue this conversation after the break, because there's a lot of stuff here I'd like to get into about what's going on in Iraq and this resolution the Senate vote that didn't happen this morning. 27 minutes past the hour, we're talking with Larry Johnson, formerly of the CIA and State Department. His website, NoQuarterUSA.net. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Follow your dreams, you follow the leader into the tree.
34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Just a quick reminder, if you want to listen again to the first hour of our program today, when we had a rather extended conversation with Bruce Fein about the reasons why Bush and Cheney should be impeached and impeached now, that have nothing to do with them being bad people, that have to do with rescuing our Constitution. Check out 620kpoj.com, www.620kpoj.com. The entire audio of the entire hour is right there. Larry Johnson's with us, former Central Intelligence Agency officer, U.S. State Department officer, expert in the fields of terrorism, aviation security, crisis, and risk management. His website, noquarterusa.net. And, Larry, we were talking about the ethnic cleansing of Baghdad. Let me just toss out how this seems to me, and tell me if it really is this craven and bizarre.
If
we had decided that Joe Biden was right back 3 years ago, and that the only way that Iraq could be governed, without a strong man like Saddam Hussein in charge, and not have the Shiites and the Sunnis fighting with each other, was to physically segregate them, to break up the integrated neighborhoods, because under Saddam, many of the neighborhoods of Iraq had become, cities all over this country had become highly integrated.
Right.
If we decided that the way to do that was to basically segregate everybody, and we went in and we moved families and we bought houses and we paid for the moving trucks and we physically made it happen. In some ways, I guess the way that, like, you know, the Palestinians were moved out to make way for the creation of Israel in the 40s, that would have at least been honest and upfront. We'd be saying, this is what we're doing. We're moving these people here, and we're moving these people here, and we're going to compensate them, and we're going to make it work, and we're going to, you know, and everything will be, you know, at least out front and in the open.
Right.
Instead, it appears that what the Bush administration has done is they've said, okay, we know this is going to happen. We know this is the only way it can work out, but we don't want to spend the money to do it. We don't want to take the time or effort to do it. So we're going to let these people do it themselves by murdering each other. And we're going to create, you know, 4 million refugees, the second largest refugee crisis in the world. And when it is ethnically cleansed, when they have become segregated, there actually will be a decrease in violence that we'll take credit for by saying that we're winning the so-called war on terror. Is that really what's going on?
To an extent. I mean, the real problem here is the Bush administration is so incompetent, so short-sighted, they haven't planned or anticipated any of this. In fact, they continue to define the, quote, the enemy in Iraq as primarily al-Qaeda, when in fact, most of the violence there is not caused by al-Qaeda, by the Islamic extremists. You do see the results, for example, in Ramadi, when they have gone through their own self-cleansing. They have eliminated most of the Shia influence, and they are now in a position to control with their local sheikhs what's going on. And so,
right. But Bush is trumpeting that as a triumph. He's saying, look at this with the Ramadi, you know, we turned it over to the local sheikhs. But the reality is that was only possible because first they had killed off or driven out all of the Sunnis, and we stood, or the Shia rather, and we stood by and watched that happen.
Well, and what it doesn't mean, though, is that therefore they are going to be cooperative with the central government, that they're going to be supportive,
right,
of the central government.
Or us, for that matter, also.
Yeah, so as long as we leave them alone, they're going to leave us alone. But, you know, where this is headed is you're going to wind up with a society that is segregated into ethnic areas, and then from there there's going to be a bit of a stalemate. So it's like, don't be surprised if we see a drop-off of violence as we go into September and October, as these ethnic cleansings come to an end, as you set up neighborhoods which are, you know, largely either Shia or Sunni. In fact, New York Times had an excellent piece today by a French journalist who went into Baghdad, lived in the red zone, everything outside the green zone. And they've even developed in Baghdad today brokers, real estate brokers, who will have Sunni and Shia families trade homes, so they each get to go to neighborhoods that are going to be largely their own ethnic group, so that, and just sort of wait and see what happens. I mean, this is bizarre, and you get that reality up against the fantastical ravings of the likes of John McCain and Lindsey Graham and Joe Lieberman, who keep insisting that things are swell in Baghdad. Well, it is not the case.
But you suggest that the reason for this is the Bush administration's incompetence.
Yeah, it is.
And yet this has been going on for 3.5 years. How could they not know that it's going on?
Because they have not brought people in at the very top who are experts and who know the area and who speak the language. And what you have from a military standpoint, you have military guys who are rotating in and out at command levels. And so you don't get any continuity there. The Bush administration continues to largely ignore the intelligence. And the sad fact is we don't have a good intelligence collection capability on the ground in Iraq to actually know what's going on. I mean, I was over there a year ago. I was with a very specialized U.S. military outfit that's carrying the battle to Al-Qaeda, and their view. And yet the reality is, despite, they've killed and captured people on a daily basis, including this latest high-profile target that was just unveiled today, even though he's been in custody for 2 weeks. And the reality is, despite focusing on their Al-Qaeda and the foreign fighters, the violence in Iraq has continued to escalate. And, you know, that tells me that no matter what it is these U.S. specialized forces are doing, it's irrelevant to what is actually happening on the ground, what the real source of the violence is.
Yeah. Now, speaking of the intelligence, we have this new intelligence estimate that just came out.
Yeah, the NIE.
And yeah, the NIE, National Intelligence Estimate. And, it you know, reading this thing through, it looks to me like, or at least reading the summaries of it, I haven't read every word of it, but it looks to me like what this thing is saying is you know, fairly common sense. Bush did not, you know, in Tora Bora, he let bin Laden get loose. Bin Laden's been hiding out in Pakistan and having a good old time. He's got Pervez Musharraf scared of him. And so it's sort of like, you know, in Afghanistan. And he's, to some extent, reconstituting what he's doing. That may represent a threat to us if he continues to perceive us as the bad guys, which, you know, obviously he's going to as long as we're over there. And that, you know, this group at Al-Qaeda that calls itself, or this group in Iraq that calls itself Al-Qaeda, is not Osama bin Laden.
Correct.
Am I getting all this right here?
Yeah.
And yet Bush is coming out and saying that they're one and the same. I mean, is the president lying to the American people? Is that an accurate description of what he said yesterday and the day before?
It's either a lie or willful ignorance. The reality here is that if the CIA, if the intelligence community, because this was a National Intelligence Council document, so it's not just CIA, it includes State Department, INR, FBI, as the, sort of the principal contributors to it. When they say that they have regenerated their capability to strike inside the United States, I have to take them at face value that that may be true. If that is true, then that is the ultimate indictment of the failure of the Bush administration, who completely took their eye off the ball of tracking down and destroying and dismantling the Al-Qaeda network and this network of Islamic extremists from the Sunni side, and instead focused their efforts on going in and starting a war of choice in Iraq, which at the time was the most secular country in the Middle East. It had the least amount of Islamic extremism present. And instead, what we've done now is we've destroyed that secularism, forcing them back into these sectarian camps where Sunni versus Shia versus Kurd, and within the Kurdish community, you have both Sunnis and Shias as well. It's an awful mess. And there is, that's why I titled my piece Driving Off the Cliff, because I was with Pat Lang, and I actually were fortunate enough to brief Senator Clinton over 2 years ago. And we told her, we said, look, you've driven off, not you, Senator Clinton, but the U.S. policy has driven off a cliff. And that means once you've gone over the cliff, you can talk about scenarios, what you're going to do, but the reality is the best thing you can do is probably dial 911, tell them where your car is going to hit, because that's the only thing that you could actually do that may make a difference.
Yeah, which basically means, and you say this in the end of your post over at noquarterusa.net, let's get out now.
Yeah, we do not have, you can change the situation on the ground if you're able to put in 500,000-600,000 troops. We would take more casualties, we would cause more Iraqi casualties, but ultimately you could get control of it. But we don't have that. So we need to stop pretending, you know, that's like saying, you know, that you've won the Publisher's Clearinghouse sweepstakes. You haven't, but if you want to live in the fantasy that you have, I guess, you know, it'll cheer your day.
Larry, we have about a half a minute. Drudge Report is breathlessly reporting, and ABC is reporting that the FBI has said that they are looking into a smuggling ring down on the Mexican border where they're bringing in Iraqis into the United States, a Mexican smuggling operation that has now turned to smuggling in Middle Easterns, citizens. Is this just more spin and hysteria?
Yeah, I think it's more spin and hysteria, and I like Carlos Mencia, the comic, because he's always pointed out, he says, you know, the Mexicans who are smuggling themselves in illegally, they've been some of the best assets in turning in Middle Easterners, folks who aren't supposed to be there. So,
that's an interesting point.
Yeah, I mean, he's got a great comic bit on it, but there's an element of truth to it. And, you know, the fact of the matter is the people coming across that border, they're coming for economic opportunity here, not to conduct terrorism.
And if they noticed a terrorist among them, they would turn them in. They have turned them in.
Absolutely. They have.
Yeah.
Been.
Very interesting point. Larry Johnson, NoQuarterUSA.net, his blog. Larry Johnson, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Great talking with you. 45 minutes past the hour. Picking up your phone calls right after this break. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call 866-303-2270.
Some stones, saw the skin and bones of a city without a soul. I went out walking under an atomic sky, where the ground won't turn and the rain it burns like the tears when I said goodbye.
And welcome back, 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service. Talk Radio News on the line. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
We had a filibuster busting party, all-night party, on the floor of the Senate. Harry Reid says this, even though he's I don't want to say giving up the fight. He they gave it 24 hours. He says this isn't the last of it.
No, he says it isn't the last of it, but I think we have to look at it this way. It kind of is for now. There's not much time before the August recess, which they and the Iraqi government are taking. There's not much more they can do right now. What they are doing is reminding the grassroots that, look, we're on the case. This is serious. This is important to us. We won another convert last night. We won over Senator Susan Collins of Maine, who was close to being won over, but nevertheless it was another vote, and we will keep on at this. But we can't. There's not much more they can do right now.
Yeah. Any idea why they didn't do this with, for example, card check? I mean, more than half of the Americans working in the United States who are not unionized say that they would join a union if it was available in their current place of work.
I think they view this as, you mean, this kind of all-nighter?
Yeah, I mean, there have been a couple of issues that were fairly large issues where the Republicans filibustered them. And I understand that the Republican caucus, this is, you know, is reported by, I think it was the Washington Post, that the Republican, you know, a bunch of Republicans got together a week or two ago and just said right out loud, I mean, just flat out, we are going to filibuster any attempts by the Democrats to pass any meaningful legislation so that they cannot claim legislative victories when they go into the 08 elections.
I think they know that this one is for the cameras. They know that this is a matter of last resort, that this is the one you do when you want to get the publicity for the big issue. And that if they did it for other issues, when it came to doing it for the issue that they really, really wanted the publicity for, which is what they got, the cameras wouldn't come. The cameras aren't going to come and film the cops for everything.
It would dilute it.
It would dilute it, yeah. And they
on the other hand, you know, back during the Gingrich era, I mean, you know, Gingrich would take up these battles. I mean, they had hundreds of, well, not hundreds, but they had certainly scores of battles on all kinds of things. It was just the continuous warfare. And, you know, finally, I say, to a large extent, the Democrats said, okay, we'll go along with this stuff. I mean, that was in 93 that Bill Clinton said the era of big government is over because he was tired of fighting with these guys.
I think Gingrich liked to fight, and he was a good battler. And it's odd that, you know, here you have Harry Reid, who is, in fact, a boxer or a wrestler. I think he's a boxer.
He's a boxer.
He's a boxer, and yet he doesn't give the impression of being somebody who wants to fight. You get the impression that Gingrich, who's a draft dodger, is a pugilist and is part-time.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting contrast. And Harry Reid, actually, wasn't he a Marine?
Something like that.
I believe so. I know he was in the military in any case. So what else is going on in Washington, D.C. right now?
Well, everybody's eyes, frankly, have been riveted on this. They're not talking about anything else. It's so interesting how the National Intelligence estimate that everybody's eyes was on yesterday, and Fran Townsend, who really ought to wear some lipstick to go with the rest of her makeup because she's got very thin lips, and that look is not great on her. Sorry about that.
That's quite all right.
Wanted to say it for 24
fashion
hours.
Commentary is always welcome.
People are just not talking about it so much. So the question is that good for the Bush administration or bad for them? It's probably good for them because no matter how she tried to spin it yesterday, that was not a good national intelligence estimate.
Yeah, yeah. Well, basically what it was saying is, you know, you guys have had, 5 years to try and clean this mess up, and you've made things worse.
And they tried to say, look, yes, Al-Qaeda may be growing, but it's not growing as much as it would have done if we hadn't been fighting it, which is a really tough stretch. And they basically pointed everything at one or two sentences within the report to back themselves up. It was a very tough sell for the Bush administration, and she did her level best, and she did a very good job. She's a very bright person. She did a very good job, but it was very difficult for her to do, and she had to make some very convoluted arguments, which the press were not buying. And I don't think that the American people are going to buy. And I think people are looking over their shoulders today going, okay, so whose city is the bomb going to hit?
Right. Yeah. This is a pretty strange one. Let's take a couple of calls here. Joe in Texarkana, Texas, has a question about the filibuster procedure. Hey, Joe, you're on with me in Victoria. Joe?
Yes. You keep saying that they filibuster, but do they actually filibuster? I mean, it seems to me like they're just threatening to filibuster, but they don't actually have to do it.
Well, they had to do it, didn't they?
Yeah, it's the Marquis of Queensbury rules. Is that what it's called, Victoria? This kind of new rule that they've adopted, where basically a Republican can stand up and say, "Okay, I'm the guy who says I'm going to filibuster this, and if you make me talk, I will." But everybody says, "Okay, we're not going to make you talk. We get it that you're willing to." That's kind of the bottom line, right?
Right, and very occasionally they call their bluff and say, "Okay, you want to talk, you can talk," and they actually make them do it. But it's very, very rare.
Okay, Jack in Memphis, Tennessee. You've got about a half a minute, Jack. What's up?
All right, let's make this fast. Bush signing all these executive orders. What can we do about it? Because, I mean, there's a lot of them that's taken away our rights.
Yeah, that's something that's going to happen. Yeah, the executive orders. His new one, Victoria, that he signed yesterday says that if you and I conspire to do anything that might diminish the forward progress in Iraq, then they can seize all of our assets. He can seize all of our assets.
I asked the State Department about this yesterday, and they about the possibilities for abuse, and they assured me that we had recourse before the courts.
Well, that's not what it says in the executive order.
That
the president, by consultation with the Secretary of Defense and the Secretary of State, can determine who gets nailed. And you don't get notice before they take all your assets. It just happens. But anyway, interesting. Victoria Jones, TalkRadioNews.com. Thanks, Victoria.
Thank you.
Tomorrow, coming up tomorrow, Larry Kudlow is going to be here. Daniel Brook on a brilliant new book, The Trap. Christy Harvey, it's going to be a great day. You know, be sure to show up. And don't forget, on Friday, I'll be in Grand Rapids. Go to WTKG.com for that. And you can hear the audio of our entire first hour today at 620KPOJ.com. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.